4.
Collier County 911, what is the address?
Hi, 6101 Pine Ridge Road. We have a code silver, someone shooting.
Okay, hold on 1 second.
Thank you.
They're inside the hospital?
I guess, yes. 3 East Nurse. Well, they keep calling for the 3 East Nurses Station.
Okay.
3E Nurses Station?
3 East. Like north, south, east?
Okay.
3 East. They call from there, but I don't know where the shooter is at right now.
I'm on the phone right now with 911. Thank you, 10-4.
Okay, who gave you the call?
We've gotten a whole bunch of calls from the Secure Perfect, from Jolynn, from who else did you get?
Gail,
the nurse supervisor, called in also.
Okay, you don't have any other information, any phone numbers we can call?
Our number is... Oh, God, hurry up. Sorry.
You don't know if anybody's hurt?
No, I don't know if anybody's I don't know if anybody's hurt.
Okay, so what did you hear? What did they tell you?
We don't know if anybody's hurt.
Okay, so how did you find out somebody was shooting in there?
Because they've been calling us.
Okay. They just said somebody was in the hospital shooting?
Yes, ma'am.
You don't have any description, any other...
Do we have any description or anything? Did they give you any description, Alex? Hurry!
We have to call the administrator on call, too. Someone shot himself?
Okay, ma'am?
Yes.
You said someone possibly shot themselves?
Wait a minute. God, everybody's knocking at the door here. There's only 2 of us here right now.
Okay. And it'll be
code blue. One moment, please. One moment, please. I'm sorry, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry.
Okay, you don't have any more information? It's just at the 3 East Nurse Station?
Hold on 1 second. The other operator's talking to someone.
Where can someone meet us? I'm sure there's a deputy on the scene already.
I'm on the phone with them right now still. Thank you.
Okay, where can someone meet us so we can speak to you guys?
Did you hear that? You guys need to get here ASAP.
Okay, in reference to what? Do you guys have more information?
I have no information. The code blue is ringing. Do you have any information? 911. No, we have no other information.
Okay.
We just have a code blue at 3 East Nurses Station. So I don't know what's going on. They're shooting or they killed themselves or something. I don't know. But they're saying that you guys need to get here right away.
Okay.
Oh, here's one policeman here now.
All right, go talk to them.
I'm sorry?
Go talk to them, okay?
No, I can't. I can't leave. I'm an operator. But I see the police running into the hospital entrance. Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
I'm Lauren.
I am Ken.
And this is Paradise After Dark.
Dark.
Paradise After Dark is a podcast covering true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
missing people,
urban legends, and the dark side of the Sunshine State.
If you'd like to support our show and get a bunch of extra Paradise After Dark content, sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/Paradise After Dark Podcast.
And be sure to visit our website.
On the website, you'll find links to all of our episodes, our mailing list, our social medias, our page store,
ooh,
and links to our Patreon.
Yeah, that's where you can find all the cool Paradise After Dark gear. And also, on there, you will find a virtual tip jar.
Leave us a tip, and we'll give you a shout-out.
Yep.
Speaking of shout-outs, Kelly from Fort Lauderdale, thank you so much for your tip this week.
And Justin from Macon, Georgia, who's making us happy.
Making us happy.
So thank you guys for your support.
We love tips.
Yep. And another special thank you to Donna Kay from last month, who bought my first Lone Star beer that I've ever had in my entire existence at CrimeCon. Thank you.
Yes, we're still sort of recovering from CrimeCon. So
we're still trying to figure out if it's real life or not. Cause,
this is real life.
Yeah, because CrimeCon is an event. I mean, it's an event.
Yes. So, yes, we are freshly back from CrimeCon. We are diving in. We've got a good one for you. This is going to be a two-parter. We are titling it A Paradise After Dark Special, A Tangled Web of Murder. And as we get going, you will understand the title of this episode. So I'm just going to dive into it. Are you ready, Ken?
Hold on, let me get a deep breath because this one here, folks, is a little crazy.
Okay. So on July 5th of 2011 at 5:43 p.m., the Collier County Sheriff's Office deputies responded to room 330 on the third floor of Physicians Regional Medical Center in Naples, Florida, regarding an unidentified male shooter. Upon further investigation, they learned that a man named Jeffrey Moritz had entered room 330 and shot his estranged wife, Christine Ann Moritz, while she was there visiting a friend who was a patient in the hospital. Before the shooting occurred, Mrs. Moritz cordially introduced her estranged husband to her friend, but Mr. Moritz quickly became confrontational with his wife. According to an official statement, Christine is heard telling Jeffrey, "Don't start here." Jeffrey responded that he was going to, quote, end it. A nurse who was in the room and saw the situation escalating ran out the door to alert security. As she left the room, she saw Jeffrey pull a pistol out of his pants and point it at Christine's head. The nurse fled the room and heard two gunshots. The patient in the room stated he watched Jeffrey shoot Christine once in the head and she collapsed to the floor. He then pointed the gun at his own chin and fired.
At this point, security and medical personnel responded to the room and discovered Mrs. Moritz dead on the floor. Jeffrey was treated for a gunshot wound to the head and was transported from the scene to a trauma center. A .380 caliber pistol was recovered from the floor adjacent to Mr. Moritz's body and was determined to be the weapon used in the shooting. Now, while being treated in the emergency room at Physicians Regional Medical Center, an additional fully loaded magazine for the .380 pistol and a fully loaded .22 caliber revolver were recovered from Mr. Moritz's clothing by the attending personnel. 3 weeks after Christine Morris's death, her on-again, off-again boyfriend, Christopher Cerna, was arrested on a murder charge in connection with a grisly killing in his North Naples apartment. But we'll get to that later. All right, so let's rewind and look at Jeffrey and Christine Morris's before this deadly encounter. Let's look at them and see how this relationship kind of turned into what we're seeing here. The Moritz were married in Erie, Ohio in 1975, right after graduating high school. They eventually moved to Collier County, Florida, where they owned a construction business called Master Builders and Remodeling. Now, their marriage, according to their son Chad, was marred by continuing domestic violence. "He'd beat my mom up real bad. If she went to the cops, he'd kill her," Chad told detectives in 2009 after Jeffrey Moritz was arrested for shooting Chad after Chad came home angry that the dentist his father sent him to couldn't pull his bad tooth. Yeah, you heard that correctly. So
did he actually shoot Chad or did he shoot at Chad?
He shot at Chad.
Okay.
So he didn't shoot Chad. So he shot at Chad because apparently this dentist that his own father sent him to said, yeah, we can't pull your tooth.
So Chad was angry that the dentist couldn't pull his tooth, so his father shot at him.
Well, of course. Isn't that what most parents do? I mean, let's get real here. Seriously.
Okay. I just want to be clear for our listeners that what kind of person we're dealing with here.
Exactly. Well, he's admitting to the continuing domestic violence, so that makes perfect sense. That remember, domestic violence isn't just usually against one person; it's usually the whole household, just
right.
A different aspect.
Exactly.
So now, when this altercation between Chad and his father Jeffrey happened, Christine Moritz, the wife and mother, told police that Jeffrey often threatened to shoot himself or overdose on pills, but denied that he abused her. And sadly, Christine later wrote to the judge asking to have the no contact order between her and Jeffrey lifted, stating she was not afraid of him. Now, when speaking to the Naples Daily News, Ann Green, a spokeswoman for the Shelter for Abused Women and Children in Naples, said women who are abused by spouses are often in denial because of fear of retaliation or financial reasons or because they mistakenly believe things will get better. But with domestic violence, there is a pattern of abuse that escalates. And filing for divorce or leaving is often the last straw for an abuser, Green said.
So 2 years later, after 36 years in an abusive marriage, Christine Moritz had had enough and separated from Jeffrey. She got a job as the lead concierge at Cap Ferrat, a condominium in the upscale Pelican Bay area. Now, if you're familiar at all with Naples, Pelican Bay is a very bougie...
It's high rent district.
Right. So she moved out of their Golden Gate Estates home and got an apartment in nearby Bonita Springs and started taking classes at the local community college, which is all great. I mean, she's doing everything she's supposed to do. She's got herself a job. She's got herself a good place to live. She's taking classes. Then she filed for divorce on June 17th of 2011.
And this is a huge step because you're eliminating those fears. You're eliminating the fear of not having money. You're eliminating the fear of not having a place to live. Your child's obviously a little bit older. I mean, so now you're filing for divorce. This is huge because now if you're in a domestic violence situation and you're feeling threatened, to do this takes so much strength and power to get
right.
on your own.
Right.
So this, understand, is, I mean, this is huge.
And as Ken had mentioned just a minute ago, filing for divorce or leaving is often the last straw for an abuser, and it's often the most dangerous time.
Yep.
So let's talk about domestic violence in general for a minute, because this is a subject I'm passionate about, and anytime I can sneak it in and talk about it, I'm going to. So according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, which is NCADV.org, on average, nearly 20 people per minute are physically abused by an intimate partner in the United States. During 1 year, this equates to more than 10 million women and men. 1 in 4 women and 1 in 9 men experience severe intimate partner physical violence, intimate partner contact sexual violence, and/or intimate partner stalking with impacts such as injury, fearfulness, post-traumatic stress disorder, use of victim services, contraction of sexually transmitted diseases, etc. 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men have been victims of severe physical violence, for example, beating, burning, strangling, by an intimate partner in their lifetime. 1 in 7 women and 1 in 18 men have been stalked by an intimate partner during their lifetime to the point in which they felt very fearful or believed that they or someone close to them would be harmed or killed. On a typical day, there are more than 20,000 phone calls placed to domestic violence hotlines nationwide.
That's 20,000.
The presence of a gun in domestic violence situation increases the risk of homicide by 500%. Intimate partner violence accounts for 15% of all violent crime. Abusers repeatedly go to extremes to prevent the victim from leaving. In fact, as I mentioned, leaving an abuser is the most dangerous time for a victim of domestic violence. One study found in interviews with men who have killed their wives that either threats of separation by their partner or actual separations were most often the precipitating events that led to the murder. So why do women and men stay in abusive relationships?
Well, can we just clarify something? Remember, abuse doesn't necessarily mean physical contact.
True.
There's a lot of aspects of abuse. So
true.
I don't know if these numbers include a lot of the other stuff, which I'm sure they do.
And if we want to go off course here for just a second and talk about abuse is not always physical.
That's what I'm saying.
There is emotional abuse. There's financial abuse. There's so many different types a person can be abused by a loved one, and it doesn't even have to be a romantic or intimate partner. It could be a sibling or a parent or a child.
And as the numbers speculate, I mean, the numbers basically dictate, it's not always a man beating a woman. I mean, there are times
where
it's not as often, but men feel these same effects.
Right. So why do men and women stay in abusive relationships? Again, according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, the fear that the abuser's actions will become more violent and may become lethal if the victim attempts to leave. Sometimes they have unsupportive friends and family.
That's a sad situation, because now that causes not only the abuse and the mental hardship that creates, but now you have no one.
Right. Well, I think sometimes that women or men in these situations, they feel that they have no one, but they have people. It's hard to reach out when it can be embarrassing to admit that you're in this situation.
That's true.
It can be hard to reach out for help. I could go on and on and on, but let's get back to this. Maybe one day we'll do a special on that. Actually, one day we are going to do a special on that, because I've already got that planned.
Got it.
So here, back to our reasons. Knowledge of the difficulties of single parenting and reduced financial circumstances. The victim feeling that the relationship is a mix of good times, love, and hope, along with the manipulation, intimidation, and fear.
So that's saying that they just feel like we love each other and these things happen?
Right.
Yeah.
The victim's lack of knowledge of or access to safety and support, which kind of goes back to what I said. They don't know that they have support. They don't know where to turn to for support. Fear of losing custody of their children if they leave or divorce their abuser, or fear the abuser will hurt or even kill their children.
That's
which
scary.
We have seen that happen to someone we actually know in real life. Lack of means to support themselves and or their children financially, or lack of access to cash, bank accounts, and assets. Now, that's where I go back to when I said financial abuse. There is something called financial abuse, where one party controls all the money and maybe gives the other party an allowance and won't let the other party work. So they have no money for themselves. And then they have the allowance, and then that party might check the bank account on a daily or more than once a day basis and question them about their purchases at the gas station or, you know, Kohl's, or why they got cash back at the grocery store. But that's neither here nor there.
It's not me. No.
Lack of having somewhere to go. Example, no friends or family to help, no money for a hotel, shelter programs are full or limited by length of stay. Fear that homelessness may be their only option if they leave. Religious or cultural beliefs and practices may not support divorce, or may dictate outdated gender roles and keep the victim trapped in a relationship. Belief that two-parent households are better for the children despite the abuse.
That's a big problem there, all of those things, because there's some times where, and I've spoken to a few women who've actually lived almost all of those, where they controlled the money, they've been abusive, they've threatened to take the kids, I said it earlier, gaslighting, is that kind of like they're constantly feeding that information, like, these are the things I'm going to do.
No, that's not really what gaslighting is.
No, could you clarify that one? Because that's also a form of abuse.
So gaslighting is when they make you question your own sanity, basically. They make you question your own beliefs. Like, say you had an argument with your significant other, and later on they say, well, I never said that. Or you took that the wrong way. That's not what I said. That's not how I said it. And then you question yourself, like, Did I misremember? And then if you are being gaslighted for a significant period of time, it can actually really, really fuck with your head and make you question your own beliefs and your own sanity and make you think that maybe you're the one that's crazy. You know, you're the one that, I don't know. It's crazy. Everybody just Google gaslighting, read about it, and...
Well, I've purposefully brought that in here because that is a form of abuse that sometimes gets left out of the equation.
Yes.
People don't realize that kind of thing there, that is a form of abuse, And it's not necessarily a physical thing, but it's more of a mental thing.
And so, and mental and emotional abuse.
Exactly. I mean, that's because the domestic violence part, I mean, and we can get off of the subject here, but this is, it's hard enough. But when you get into this point, that's where the mental health comes in and the victim is. So sometimes the victim is not only suffering the abuse, but then you get the mental aspect of it. So they're getting hit from all different directions.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's really hard to describe all the ways because there's so many different forms of it. So you just got to be aware of exactly, and I don't, we're not trying to get people to question everything that happens, but there's so much out there, and it definitely applies in this case because there was so much, not this case, but all these cases we're going to talk about tonight in this web here. There's a lot of little bugs wrapped up in this web. Okay, so now that we've discussed all this and got all this out about domestic violence and the things to look at, let's also look at Christine Moore's situation. First, it needs to be said that before Christine left Jeffrey, she began an affair with a coworker named Christopher Cerna. Now, brought together by work, talks about religion and shared stories of their dissolving marriage, Christine and Cerna, well, it gets confusing with the name, so I'll go ahead and clarify. It's Christine Moritz and Christopher Cerna, but we're just going to refer to her as Christine and him as Cerna. Can I do that?
Yeah.
Okay, that, as long as we clarify that. Now, they began an intimate relationship in early of 2011, and this is about 4 months before she moved out of her Golden Gate Estates home that she shared with her husband and moved to Benita Springs that Lauren mentioned earlier. Now, 1 week after Christine Moritz was killed, detectives interviewed Cerna about the shooting. And he was cooperative. He was forthcoming with the investigation during was it July 12th?
July 12th is when they interviewed him, yeah.
And Cerna described the relationship as a casual affair. It makes sense. I mean, they're friends, basically, and it happened.
With benefits.
Exactly. Well, she's in a situation where she really hasn't felt loved. So in that situation, sometimes it's easy to feel extremely loved. And I'm sure that, you know, Cerna was probably at the time was pretty genuine. Now, Cerna said Jeffrey Moritz learned of his wife's contact with him through call records, text messages on her phone. So obviously he's going through her phone, found this stuff out. And Jeffrey Moritz confronted Cerna once over the phone, asking if he was having an affair with Christine. Now, Cerna said he was not. Jeffrey Moritz insinuated to him that bad things are going to happen if he found out otherwise. Cerna told investigators he believed Jeffrey Moritz might have mistaken Christine's friend for him at the hospital the day of the murder, but that wasn't him. So
no, it was not Christopher Cerna that she was visiting in the hospital. And when this happened, I remember that this was a sort of a rumor that it was Christopher Cerna who was in the hospital and Christine was visiting him, but it was not. It was another friend and coworker, but it wasn't Cerna.
Well, before the murder, Christine repeatedly shared with Cerna her concerns about her estranged husband, Jeffrey. So she was forthcoming with Cerna and explained to him that
what her situation
exactly,
was.
Exactly, that's my situation. And Cerna, obviously, he knew the situation, but obviously wasn't worried about the situation, even after being confronted.
Right.
So now she knew it was going to happen. She always said it, Cerna told investigators a week after the murder. She knew that she was going to die by his hand. So she was so scared, she told her lover that this was going to happen.
Yep.
So she's almost like she knew. So she's going to Cerna and explaining, hey, this is how bad my situation is. I think he's going to kill me. And when someone says that, that's an eye-opener. If anyone ever tells you that,
pay attention.
You need to start paying attention.
Take them seriously.
Exactly, because somebody knows something and they're saying something. Just listen, write it down, document it, put a note in your phone, you know, something. Because Cerna told investigators that several weeks before her death, Christine no longer wanted to see him because she was afraid her husband would find out. So now she doesn't want to see her lover because she's scared to death that something's going to happen to Cerna because he might find out and do something to both of them.
Right.
Now, Sandra Schock, a general manager of Cap Ferrat, told the investigators that Jeffrey Moritz called her once to make a request. Quote, he wanted me to fire Christine to stop the relationship with Cerna so he could have his wife back. So now he's called her boss and said, hey.
Asked her boss to fire her.
So obviously now you can, when this starts transpiring, you know, the thing is, you don't know this until the story comes together.
Right.
And now we can
it's
tell
always
you this.
Hindsight is 2020.
So I mean, we're sitting here, we're telling you the story, but these are the things that, you know, certain people knew certain things, but they didn't quite put them all together like we are tonight.
So Christine's coworkers and family described Jeffrey Morris as a controlling spouse with whom she had difficulties. I think that's what bothered him as much as anything else. He didn't have control over her anymore, Kim Morris, the couple's daughter-in-law, said. Now let's get back to the shooting. Now after he shot and killed his wife, Jeffrey Morris turned the gun on himself, but he didn't die. He was immediately airlifted from Physicians Regional Hospital in Naples to the trauma center at Lee Memorial Hospital in nearby Fort Myers. 6 days later, he had recovered enough to be released to the custody of the Collier County Sheriff's Office, and he was arrested on charges of second-degree murder.
Second-degree murder.
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure why that happens. Why does it seem like the universe protects the guilty?
It doesn't.
It just seems that way sometimes.
I really couldn't speculate why the prosecutors would charge him right off the bat with second-degree murder. Usually I think that they go in with the highest charges they can get, but I don't know, maybe the fact that he tried to kill himself, I don't know.
Yeah, well,
I really don't know. I can't speculate on that. I don't know.
I've got a few choice words, but I'll save them. He needs to be a better shot when he's doing that. But anyway, that being said, it's neither here or there. Now, no surprise, of course, that we talked about. Now they're going to go for second-degree murder. But, of course, the defense attorney has a job to do. And there's no surprise that his trial attorney, Jerry Berry, he tried to use the heat of passion defense.
We've heard that name several times here on this podcast.
Yeah, and remember, Jerry Berry is not a bad attorney.
No, Jerry Berry is a
fantastic
attorney.
At this, that's why I said the defense has a job to do. He was hired to do a job. And so, of course, this is what they do. And they go after whatever they can. And we all know this based on the Jodi Arias trial. We know this on the Casey Anthony trial. The defense attorney is going to do whatever they can do to save their client. That's their job. So with that being said, Morris's legal team asked the jurors to find him guilty of a lesser charge of manslaughter, arguing the killing was committed in the heat of passion. This is a defense under Florida law that bumps a murder conviction down to manslaughter. Now, Morris never denied shooting his wife. He said he was worked into a jealous fit by suspicion of his wife's affair with a coworker that we spoke about earlier, Serna. Testifying in his own defense, Morris described himself as heartbroken after the breakdown of his marriage and discovery of phone records suggesting his wife's affair with Serna. Now, Morris said he and his wife met and had sex 4 times in the weeks before the shooting, giving a hope for reconciliation, but a sudden realization that the marriage would never be repaired, combined with finding his wife's car at a hospital, drove him to go into the hospital that afternoon and shoot. This is what Morris testified. Now, he claimed he didn't recall the moments leading up to the killing. And the reason being, according to
Florida State Statute 782.03, excusable homicide. Homicide is excusable when committed by accident and misfortune in doing by any lawful act by unlawful means with unusual ordinary caution and without any lawful intent, or by accident and misfortune in the heat of passion upon any sudden and sufficient provocation or upon sudden combat without any dangerous weapon being used and not done in a cruel or unusual manner. Now, does this apply? No, I don't believe it applies.
Tell me why.
Because it even says here in the Florida statute, without any dangerous weapon being used and not done in a cruel and unusual manner. So, would you call a 380 handgun a dangerous weapon?
If in the wrong hands, like someone like Jeffrey Morris, absolutely.
In any hands, it's a weapon. It can kill someone.
Oh, absolutely. So and definitely a dangerous weapon. I was being kind of smartass there.
Yeah.
Because they also found the other gun on him too.
And is it not cruel and unusual to go into a hospital and shoot someone in the head?
Yeah. So
this excusable homicide, heat of passion, a heat of passion excuse would be if a husband walks in on his wife in bed, engaged in sexual intercourse with another man, goes into a blind rage and beats his wife or the man with his fists without having any cooling off time, no time to think about it. It's just a instant reaction, a blind rage, heat of passion. That's the excusable homicide, heat of passion defense. Now, Jeffrey Moritz was armed with two guns.
Mm-hmm.
He found his wife's car in the parking lot. Now, who knows if he was following her there or he put a GPS in her car.
He had to, because trust me, this hospital is huge, and you have to actually physically pull off of the side road to get to the hospital.
How the hell would he even know what room she was in?
You're not going to drive by this hospital and see a car parked there. So he obviously followed her in every aspect.
So this is not going to fly.
But I have a question for you.
Passion is not going to fly.
You've worked for defense lawyers before.
Yes.
So what other option do they have based on the facts of this case?
They don't.
They don't have any. This is it.
The only thing that they have is second-degree murder, basically.
Well, temporary insanity,
They could try the insanity defense.
But the insanity defense brings opens up a whole bunch of other doors, which people don't understand. That when you plead insane, that's a whole different sect of laws. So you have to have tests done by both the defense and the prosecution. It's a lot involved to plead insanity. But this, based on what they had, is probably the best defense they'd come up with. Granted, the wrong defense.
So to prove the crime was committed in a heat of passion, Mort's defense team had to show that the killing was committed with an absence of malice upon a sudden and sufficient provocation. Prosecutors noted that Moritz showed up unannounced at the hospital as his wife visited a coworker armed with two handguns and two knives.
Yeah, two knives.
Okay. So he had 3 months to contemplate his marriage after the couple's April breakup and June filing for the dissolution of marriage.
That's right.
Prosecutors painted Moritz as an angry, controlling husband whose suspicions of his wife's affair and frustration over her newfound independence drove him to violence. This was a man who was going to make sure that his wife, who wanted freedom, who wanted out of this marriage, was going to go to her grave with him, Assistant State Attorney Mara Manzano said during closing arguments. Now, in his closing arguments, defense lawyer Jerry Berry said Moritz longed for reconciliation with his wife, and the fact that Moritz shot himself underneath the chin seconds after killing his wife shows his lack of malice.
I'm not sure it does. But I guess you have to preach that to the choir, so to speak.
Because you never, when somebody does a murder-suicide, it's kind of hard to ask them after they've committed suicide, why'd you kill yourself?
Yeah.
Did you kill yourself because you knew that you were going to go to prison for the rest of your life? Or did you kill yourself because you really wanted to die with whoever your victim was?
Exactly. So at trial, they presented that, he shot himself under the chin, which makes you think that he didn't do it in malice. He was... The whole situation is, quote, heat of passion.
And unfortunately, in all my research, I have never found any sort of interview or anything from Jeffrey Moritz stating why he turned the gun on himself after he cold-bloodedly murdered his wife.
Maybe he was trying to commit suicide, but at his sentencing trial, it was revealed that in a jailhouse letter to his granddaughters, months after killing Christine Moritz, now this is significantly later.
Well, no, but this is while he's in jail before he goes to trial.
This is before trial? I thought it was after a sentencing.
No, this was before his trial, while he was in jail awaiting trial.
Okay, then I misunderstood that. I misread that somewhere. Because he called Christine a selfish, self-centered slut. And he wrote about, quote, what she did to me, faulting his wife and her dalliance with a coworker. Quote, do not blame me for her death. This is what he tells his granddaughters. Now, prosecutors requested him to be sentenced to life in prison, citing these letters as showing his, quote, true colors. That makes sense. Think about it. I mean, this is the stuff he's writing to the kids somehow.
His granddaughters.
Exactly. So he's putting this out there like, okay, so this is how he feels about this woman that was this heat of passion scenario. We're going to call her things like a self-centered slut. Come on, man. You guys are split up. This is what happens. You understand what I'm saying? Am I just talking to myself over here?
No, I understand what you're saying.
Okay, sometimes I feel about myself. Now, this was not love, and that's what the assistant state attorney, Mara Mazzano, said. This is the ultimate act of domestic violence. And the Collier Circuit Court Judge James Shenko rejected Mort's request for the minimum required 25-year prison sentence and handed down a life sentence to him. So Jeffrey Mort gets a life sentence.
Life in prison.
Suck it up, Buttercup.
But wait, there's more.
Mm.
Remember, we just talked a lot about Christine's lover, Christopher Serna.
And here's where the web begins.
Now let's focus on him and what he got up to after Christine's murder. But first, we're going to play you a little clip.
Okay, dispatch.
Sorry, County 911, what is the address to your emergency?
This is Lee County 911 with an alternate routed call at Cypress Way East and Immokalee Road.
Okay. Sorry, sir, do you have the exact address? Sir?
Yes.
Okay, do you know the exact address where you're at?
This is apartment number.
Okay, as the apartment number?
Naples Keep, Cypress Way East. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and your apartment number?
It ain't got no apartment, it's just one.
So it's a house?
No, it's an apartment.
Okay. So somebody assaulted you, is that what happened?
What's that?
Somebody assaulted you?
No.
Okay, so what happened with...
He's inside. He won't tell us.
What happened with him? You don't know?
No. There's blood. He's got somebody in there, but there's blood all over the floor.
Okay, you don't know if he was stabbed or hit or what happened?
No, he's up.
Did you get to talk to him?
I talked to him, but he didn't want to say nothing.
Okay. How long have you been there?
Oh, about 15, 20 minutes.
Okay, where is he bleeding from?
He ain't bleeding. He's just got blood on his hands.
Okay. So you don't know if he's cut or anything?
No, he's probably... I can't see no cut on him.
And there's somebody else in the house, you said?
He probably do. I don't know. He won't let us in.
Is he suicidal? Anything like that?
No.
Okay. You're in the driveway right now?
Yes, I'm in the driveway, but they turned on the wrong one.
Okay.
Farther up.
Okay. Hold on one second.
I'm standing right on the road.
Okay, what type of vehicle do you have?
What's that?
What type of vehicle do you have?
We're on the wrong side of the apartment. There's two. Oh, there they come.
Okay, do they see you?
Yeah.
Okay, wave them down, okay?
Yeah.
Let me know when they're right with you.
Okay. They're right here. All right, they stop.
All right, go talk to them. All right, thank you, sir.
Okay, so I know that phone call was hard to understand, but that was Christopher Serna's father calling 911 because he had gone to his son's apartment and found his son in the apartment covered in blood, and his son wouldn't allow him inside. He did not know what was going on, why there was blood everywhere, and his son wouldn't speak to him. So on July 26, 2011, the then 38-year-old Serna was found in his North Naples condo with the mutilated dead body of one of his girlfriends, 45-year-old Suzanne Bishop. This was 3 weeks to the day after Christine Moritz was murdered.
And the voice that's on the call, the 911 call, was Serna's parents.
That's what I just mentioned. That was Serna's father. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So they come and they find Serna at his apartment. He's covered in blood. And at first, they didn't even see Suzanne Bishop. They thought that Serna was the victim of an assault. But then they realized right away that the son wasn't the victim.
Right.
And so when police come to the house, they said Serna was withdrawn. He was sitting on a black box and shaking uncontrollably, and he was unable to speak. So the police enter his condo, and they find blood everywhere. I mean, it's smeared all over the walls. It's on the carpet. It's everywhere. And on the wall was written in blood. There was two sets of initials written in blood. There was CAM, which we can assume is Christine Ann Moritz, and KMD, which is the initials of his ex-wife. Now, Serna and his ex-wife, they had a contentious divorce, in a custody proceeding, and he was still married when he started his affair with Christine.
Yeah, so his divorce and custody stuff was very recent. He was still married when he started his affair with Christine. So this is all happening. Christine is murdered. He gets divorced. He goes through a contentious child custody proceeding. So Serna and Bishop had a strange relationship, according to his family. The two went on a few dates over a period of 6 months before randomly moving in together shortly before he killed her. Bishop had previously been in a relationship with Christopher Serna's uncle, which struck many people as strange.
Huh?
And Suzanne Bishop had been dating Serna's uncle.
Okay, that's okay. Red flag.
Serna was warned by his family and co-workers not to continue a relationship with Suzanne, according to new documents obtained by the Naples Daily News from the state's attorney's office. Though no one predicted Suzanne's grisly death, those who knew Serna said they were concerned about a potentially problematic relationship between the two. "I told him she looked like trouble and to stay away from her," Adelina Serna, the suspect's mother, told investigators. Now, Adelina Serna, who lives a few miles from her son's condo, told investigators she didn't know much about Bishop. She met her only once, but told deputies she acted crazy and would call her son all the time.
And you've got some reservations about this part.
Yeah, I hate telling this portion of the story because it feels a little like victim blaming, but these are facts that we have actually pulled from the police reports. So it's an important part of the story. Now, Suzanne Bishop, no matter what she did, she never
deserved
did anything to deserve to be murdered.
Yeah, that's adamant in any situation.
And friends and relatives of Bishop have called her a caring mother and a good friend, but said that she had a troubled past. That's a little murky. I could not really find much information about what this troubled past may have been.
And at this point, it's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant.
So it's probably best that we didn't. Now, do you think that the family kind of pressured him a little bit because she dated the uncle? I mean, obviously, he was aware that she had dated his uncle. I mean, based on what you said.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wonder if this caused like a rift between the family and Serna. I don't know. I don't know.
But I think that maybe that's where we should end this part one.
Okay.
Because there's a lot more to get to, and we will be back tomorrow night with part two.
Okay, so yeah, that's good. This is good.
This is good. Come back tomorrow for part two because there's a lot more to the story.
Yeah, it gets interesting, even more interesting from here on out.
And again, if you'd like to support the show, please subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/ParadiseAfterDarkPodcast.
Like I said earlier, check out our website for all the links to the social media, the Patreon, merch store, and more. Definitely check it out because Lauren is very, very active on all platforms.
Please make sure to subscribe to the show on whatever platform you're listening on and rate and review. This really helps us branch out and reach a wider audience.
And as always, thank you so much for listening
to Paradise After Dark.
Duck, 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 duck.